Welcome. Before we jump back into Dogen, a few words about Buddha nature from other sources, just to keep us circling around the ancient and diverse tradition of Buddha nature teachings. Juri, the about 5th or 6th century founder of the Tiantai school of Buddhism, which greatly influenced Chan and Zen, and influenced Dogen quite a bit. Dogen was actually ordained as a priest in the Tendai tradition before converting to Zen. So Juri, in many, many years before Dogen in China, taught this threefold Buddha nature. And I just appreciated this teaching that from the very beginning, Buddha nature has this kind of built-in problem of sounding very close to something like a fixed self, an unchanging permanent entity, substantialism, we might say. So Juri, addressing that concern, came up with this idea of threefold Buddha nature, being Buddha nature as the way things are, which is one of the conditions for Buddhahood. Buddha nature as the wisdom that illuminates the way things are, also necessary for Buddhahood. And Buddha nature as the practice that perfects this inherent disposition for wisdom. So it's kind of like the way things are, the wisdom that realizes the way they are, and the practice that brings forth this wisdom. All those are what we call Buddha nature. It's not so much that just the way things are is the Buddha nature, and then there's the practice, but the wisdom and the practice are also themselves Buddha nature. Yeah, so without going into all the details about that, I feel some resonance with Juri's teaching and Dogen's teaching about Buddha nature. It's not a static, fixed something out there that we have to find. It's the very mind, the wisdom mind, that's realizing it, being it, and the practice that's manifesting it. And a few more words from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, which we might say is the main sutra source for this whole essay of Dogen. Remembering that this is what he quotes at the very beginning of the essay. All sentient beings have Buddha nature. Comes from this long, complex sutra. But again, this is this chapter 33 out of many chapters. From which that actual line comes, the Dogen quotes, and it's particularly on these different ways of looking at Buddha nature. The Buddha is talking to one of the bodhisattvas and says, "Oh, good man, if a person sees the non-eternal or non-permanent, non-self, non-bliss, non-pure, of all things," and you might recall that these are the characteristic marks of all conditioned things in the early teachings of the Buddha. Particularly, all conditioned things are impermanent, they have no self, and they're marked by discontent or suffering. And you could add in that fourth of they're impure, meaning like they're distorted by our dualistic conceptions. So here he says, if a person sees those teachings, not the impermanence, the not-self, the non-bliss, or in other words, suffering, and non-pure of all things, and sees also the non-eternal, or impermanence, non-bliss, non-self, and non-pure of the non-all things. So that's kind of literally how it looks like it reads in Chinese. The non-all things. Such a person does not see Buddha nature. So, might have to repeat that. So, if someone sees these four characteristic marks of all things, the impermanence, the not-self, the non-pure, and the non-bliss of all things. In the early teachings, one would say, if you see those, you actually see the Dharma, the Buddha might say in the early teachings. But here he says, if you see those four aspects of all things, but you also see those four aspects of the non-all things, maybe we could call that emptiness or true suchness or Buddha nature, then you don't see Buddha nature. In other words, it's a kind of like maybe awkward way of saying, or awkward translation, the fact that this non-all, this non-all things, or basically the non-thingness of suchness or emptiness, isn't that way that things are. That Buddha nature, and as this sutra is maybe the main source for teaching, that Buddha nature has these four opposite qualities of permanence. We're gonna hit on this topic, this class probably, this issue of permanence in Buddha nature. But traditionally in this sutra, Buddha nature is permanent. It's bliss, actually. It's not discontent and lack of bliss. It's complete satisfaction. Bliss, in fact. It's what are the other ones? It's not no self, but it's self. Maybe the most radical one, capital S kind of self. And it's pure. It's not impure. It's completely pure of all these dualistic conceptions. So Buddha is saying, if you see this early teaching of mine that all things have these four characteristics of no, let's see if you can remember them. What are the four?
No self.
Impermanence. Impurity. And non-bliss or suffering. Yeah. This is actually like a great list to remember. I would say really important teaching of early Buddhism. Those are the characteristics of all conditioned phenomena. And that's why this is so radical in this Mahayana Sutra, that it's teaching the opposite.
But in this context, not the the three or four seals?
Yeah, that's what we could call it. Yep, yeah, the three or four seals.
Yeah,
And then we might call these four seals of Buddha nature, these other four. I've mentioned this before, but in one of our common chants, the Enmeijuku Kanangyo, we have that line, Jo Raku Ga Jo, and that's these four. So it's kind of like interestingly, this 10-phrase life prolonging, life extending, Avalokiteshvara, invoking sutra that we do for well-being ceremonies, is kind of invoking these four qualities of Buddha nature. Jo, Raku, Ga, Jo. There's two Jos, so I can't remember which comes first, but permanence is Jo. Raku means bliss. Ga means self. It actually is the character they use to translate Atman. And the other Jo is pure. So we're chanting that. Pure self, eternal bliss. The Buddha, the world-honored one, sees the non-eternal, non-self, non-bliss, and non-pure of all things, and also sees the eternal bliss, self, and pure of the non-all. Because of this, he sees the Buddha nature just as one would see a mango that is resting in one's own palm. And later in this chapter, the Buddha talks about sentient beings don't see this Buddha nature at all, and bodhisattvas on the path to Buddhahood see it like a little bit, like kind of like through a veil. I can't remember the image. And then Buddha see it like a mango in their palm, very directly. I mentioned this before, but I bring it up again, these four qualities of Buddha nature. And now just a little bit more. This is also from the Indian tradition. We might say that Tathagata Garbha and Buddha nature are synonyms, right? And there's a few sutras that are the classic sources that I've mentioned before. The Mahaparinirvana Sutra is a very important major sutra. The Lankavatara Sutra, as you know. And there's a Tathagata Garbha Sutra. Also Srimala Devi Sutra. I mentioned before. Maybe those four, maybe most important, well known, and continue to be studied in the Dharma realm as the Mahayana Sutras that teach Buddha nature a little bit differently, but they're all considered authentic sutras. This is in the Indian Shastra tradition, the commentarial tradition. The great Indian panditas, Nagarjuna, at least attributed to Nagarjuna, there is one text, Dharmadhatu Stava, that's on Buddha nature, and maybe some debate about whether our Nagarjuna wrote it or not, but it looks like to me that the agreement is basically that this is a teaching of Nagarjuna, a Buddha nature. And but the main, maybe the main Indian ancient text is this one, this book's called Buddha Nature, but the text called by Asanga. So sometimes we say Nagarjuna and Asanga are the two great chariots of Mahayana Buddhism as far as actual living people. That founded, we could say, the middle way, Madhyamaka school, and the Yogacara, or mind-only school, Nagarjuna and Asanga. Vasubandhu is Asanga's brother, so they kind of co-founded that school. Anyway, this is Asanga as kind of Asanga channeling Maitreya Buddha, without going into the details about that. That's what they say. It's called the Uttara Tantra Shastra, which means like the unexcelled continuum, or maybe the original title is Ratna Gotra Vibhanga. Ratna is like jewel, and Gotra is like a word for Buddha nature. Another one of the synonyms that means like the kind of like lineage or family of Buddhas. There's all these kind of synonymous Sanskrit terms, so that like the dual lineage of Buddha nature exposition. And it's a wonderful teaching that is basically based on the sutras that I just mentioned. Sort of expounds on those sutras, and then many teachings, both in Chinese and Tibetan, comment on this text. But here's just a few what I think of as beautiful verses. So this is on these four. We could call them transcendent qualities of Buddhahood. And actually, it looks like in the Sanskrit, they're called paramitas. You know, paramita means gone across to the other shore, or going across to the other shore. We usually think of them as these six practices, right? Like dana paramitas, like the translate as the transcendent generosity. The giving that goes beyond all our conceptions of giving, right? And prajna paramita, wisdom beyond wisdom, beyond all our ideas of wisdom. But it can also be used here, like it's the nitya, you know, anitya is impermanence. So this is nitya is permanence, but it's the nitya paramita. We could say the transcendent permanence. It's the atma paramita, the transcendent self, the sukha paramita, the transcendent bliss, and the shubha paramita, transcendent purity. So this verse here is that talking about Buddha nature, it's purity, since its nature is pure, and even the remaining imprints are fully removed, all conceptual overlays are fully removed. It is true self, since all conceptual elaboration in terms of self and non-self is totally stilled. Right? That's a nice way of talking. What do you mean this Atman, this self? How can you say this, Buddha? So this is a little one sentence commentary on what the true self means. Its true self, since all conceptual elaboration in terms of self and non-self is totally stilled, pacified. All the conceptual elaboration about this duality of self and no-self, that's put to rest, and that's what we call the transcendent self. Its true happiness, or bliss, since even the aggregates of mental nature and their causes are reversed. Basically, the five skandhas that are the source of suffering are reversed. We could say a lot, but say our usual understanding of them is reversed. It is permanence, since the cycle of existence and the state beyond pain are realized as one. In other words, nirvana is usually taught as this permanent state. I don't know if state's the right word. Nirvana is unchanging bliss. Nirvana doesn't come and go. But this true permanence it's true permanence, since the cycle of existence, samsara, and the state beyond pain, nirvana, are realized as one. It's called true permanence because the permanent nirvana and impermanent samsara are realized as one. Thus we call it true permanence. So you could say, it's just, why do we call it that instead of true impermanence? That's what the Buddha decided to do. But it's basically, you can see all of them, all of these transcendent paramita qualities are basically transcending the dualities between them and their opposites, between self and not self, between permanence and impermanence. I bring this up as because this is all background for Dogen's comments as we continue. This is another one that I think relates to Dogen's teachings. This Buddha nature, it manifests as inverted views in ordinary sentient beings, and it has views in parentheses, so I think it might actually literally say it manifests as inverted sentient beings. Buddha nature manifests as sentient beings. That's a big statement. And it also manifests as the reversal of these inverted views in those who see the truth, and it manifests as it is in a completely uninverted way as freedom from all elaboration in a Tathagata or a Buddha. So Buddha nature manifests in these three ways as the unpurified, this is another verse, the unpurified, the both unpurified and purified, or like maybe we could say partially purified, and the utterly purified phases are expressed in this order by the names sentient being, bodhisattva, and Tathagata. So this is Buddha nature manifests as sentient beings, bodhisattvas, and Buddhas. And it's the same Buddha nature. It's one Buddha nature can manifest in these three ways. I think this is kind of nice because we don't just mix it all together and say sentient beings are Buddhas and there's no difference at all, because that just takes away any reason to practice or anything. But we also say there's one Buddha nature that's just, it's just manifesting in these, manifestation is like an appearance. Buddha can appear as sentient beings, it can appear as bodhisattvas on the path, and it can appear as fully realized Buddhas. And you could say, well, that's kind of discriminating between sentient beings and Buddhas, but you could also say, well, it's not really discriminating, because it's one Buddha nature that's just appearing in different ways, and we don't deny appearances, and appearances include difference. So I thought that was kind of a nice verse, particularly because it uses this word manifest, which I don't know what it is in Sanskrit, but this is the more I look, the more we read this and study Dogen's Buddha Nature essay, the more I feel like this word manifest, the gen of Genjo Koan, manifest or appear, is a really key term that Dogen's is using to express his understanding of Buddha nature. That Buddha nature manifests or appears as basically everything. So, lastly, I think there was one other verse. This one, this is more like a practice instruction, maybe, about Buddha nature. The truth of the self-sprung ones, is one of the various epithets for the Buddha, the Buddha's self-sprung, the Buddha sprung from himself. Buddha is like the full flowering of Buddha nature. So he kind of like, he didn't come from somewhere else. Buddha sprung from Buddha-ness. The truth of the self-sprung ones is to be realized through faith. And the truth of the self-sprung ones, in this case, is Buddha nature. It's to be realized through faith. The orb of the sun blazes with light, but it's not seen by the blind. sun of Buddha nature is always shining, but the blind don't see it. But through faith, we can trust in Buddha nature that develops through hearing these teachings and meditating on them. We open to it more and more. The next verse is, nothing whatsoever is to be removed. Not the slightest thing is to be added. Truly looking at truth, truth is seen. When seen, this is complete liberation. I just like that verse because from these ancient Indian teachings, it sounds like a Zen verse. Nothing whatsoever is to be removed. Not the slightest thing is to be added. That's how when we have faith in Buddha nature, that's what we see. Is we don't need to add anything to Buddha nature to improve it. We don't need to subtract anything to make it better. Nothing to be added or removed. Just seeing it as it is, liberation is realized. So what do we say in the song of the trusting mind? The way is perfect like vast space where nothing is lacking and nothing's extra. Nothing's lacking, so we don't need to add anything. There's nothing extra in it, so we don't need to subtract anything. And that I would propose the way that the third ancestor is talking about is another name for Buddha nature. Let's go to Dogen. So we left off at, as for the sixth ancestor's utterance, people have north or souths, Buddha nature does not. Remember that utterance last week? As for that utterance, quote, people have north and south, Buddha nature does not, unquote. It is something you should dip deep within again and again for a long period of time. You must have the capacity to take it in. You must quietly ponder the utterance in all its facets. So this is Dogen, as he often does. We think, doesn't Dogen just say, think of not thinking? And like right here, as he does quite regularly, he says, take up a saying like this and ponder it deeply, dip deeply into it, really work it for a long time. You must quietly ponder the utterance in all its facets. To imagine, as the foolish do, that the sixth ancestor has said, since human beings have substance, or like a self nature, they have a south or a north. But since the Buddha nature is an all-pervading emptiness or vacancy, devoid of substance, we cannot talk of it having a south or north. That is unmitigated stupidity. You must cast that mistaken notion aside and apply yourself assiduously without a moment's delay. So when you hear that, you might think, ah, that's how I was thinking of it. That stupid way that will... beings have substance. So I think I think there's some subtlety in the terms he's using. And you might recall that last week we talked about moo, oo, and koo. Moo and oo are these opposites of non-existence and existence. Moo is like just a negation. That means doesn't exist or no. And koo means shunyata, emptiness. And I understand the way that Dogen's using the word ku or emptiness, and I think other people use it this way too. is emptiness, I could say, goes beyond and embraces U and Ku. It's kind of the non-duality of existence and non-existence. Or emptiness is the freedom from the extremes of U and Ku, of U and Mu. Ku is the freedom from extremes of U and Mu. Emptiness is the freedom of from the extremes of existence and non-existence. It's the middle way. Nagarjuna says emptiness is the middle way. It's not a negation. So anyway, and then I said there's this other word, ko, that was sometimes used to translate emptiness, that means like, also can mean like empty or space or vacant. So I think for our purposes of our translation, I think it might be nice to say vacancy. Even though they all have similar meanings, again, there's maybe nuances in the Chinese that we don't know. But that's the word he uses here. He doesn't use shunyata ku, he uses ko. Let's say hollow. Actually, my dictionary said ko can mean hollow, void, or empty. So I think what he's talking, this foolish view he's talking about, is when we kind of rigidly solidify sentient beings as like truly existent, which they're not, because they're Buddha nature emptiness. And when we solidify Buddha nature as a kind of like vacant nothingness, I think that's what he's talking about. So if you hear it that way, he says, to imagine, as the foolish do, that the six ancestors said, since human beings have this substance, this true self nature, they have a south and a north, because they really exist. But since Buddha nature is an all-pervading, vacant, hollow, void, devoid of substance, we can't talk of that as having north or south. So almost like this very divided split between them. These are like this, so they have north and south. That's nothing, that has no north and south. It's close to the truth, but it's a little too extreme. That's how I would understand Dogen's admonition here. And we do that so easily, right? We hear these terms, and it's so easy to start falling into a kind of settled place of like, oh, this means this, got it. We kind of solidify it, or even the mu side, we start to solidify into like nothing at all. So Dogen's constantly trying to bring us back to the middle way again and again. Okay, we're ready for a new story. Moving on. This is one of the central stories of this fascicle. The sixth ancestor, Huineng, taught his disciple Xingchang, impermanence is in itself Buddha nature. Permanence is, as such, the dualistic mind that discriminates all dharmas, good and bad. So, if you recall conversation from a few minutes ago, that this is like, wait a second, because we say one of the characteristics of Buddha nature is permanence, transcended permanence, but Buddha nature emphasizes the permanent, and conditioned things, like the mind that discriminates dharmas and good and bad and all of these things, that discriminating mind, that's the impermanent, coming and going dharmas. Right, so he reverses them here. So before Dogen's commentary, here's the extended version from the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Ancestor. And it's interesting because it's got some nice stories to go with it, but also there's some explanation in here, in this original story that Dogen doesn't bring up that I think is really helpful. You also get a sense for the Sixth Ancestor. Great sixth ancestor, Huineng, our wonderful maybe some might say, most important Chinese ancestor ever. It really kind of set Zen going on its Zen path. The Platform Sutra of the Six Ancestors, the first major Zen Chan teaching in early China. And incidentally, we're the Soto school, right? So So is they're referring to two different places and names, the So and the To. And some people say Sozan and Tozan. Tozan's Dongshan, important ancestor in our lineage, and Sozan was his student. But Sozan named himself, as I understand it, after So Ke, which is the creek, the location where the sixth ancestor lives. So even if we say it's Sozan, he, out of honoring the sixth ancestor, kind of named himself after that. And some people say that it actually isn't about Sozan, because he's not in our lineage. He's not in the Soto lineage. It's kind of funny. And also So comes before To. So some people say the So actually refers to the sixth ancestor. Our Soto lineage is our two great parents of the Chinese Soto lineage could be said to be the sixth ancestor, Huineng, and Dongshan. His teachings are very complementary and quite wonderful. So here's this is in Red Pine's version, page 291. Early versions of the Platform Sutra don't have this part, so if you have another translation, you might not have this story. The monk Jurje. Xingchan. Okay. Monk Jurje was a native of Jiangxi. His original name was Chang Xingchan. And he engaged in daring exploits as a youth. Despite the division into the southern and northern schools, the leaders of the two factions did not compete with each other. This is actually in the text of the Platform Sutra. We heard about the northern and southern schools. So southern school, sixth ancestor. They were divided in their understanding of pretty subtle differences in their understanding, but they didn't compete with each other. The leaders didn't. But their followers, however, harbored sectarian feelings, and the disciples of the northern school established their master Shen Yu as the sixth ancestor. Because they were jealous that people knew about the transmission of the ancestor's robe, they sent Xingchang, our ancestor, our teacher in Dogen's story, who was just an ordinary thug at this point, who engaged in daring exploits as a youth. They hired him to assassinate the sixth ancestor. Intriguing. Out of jealousy. But the sixth ancestor had such powers of perception that he foresaw this, and he placed 10 ounces of gold beside his meditation cushion. When Xingchang entered the ancestor's room late one night, hoping to kill him, Huineng stretched out his neck. Right here. Hit it here. Xingchang hacked at it several times, but failed to make even a mark. The master, Huineng, said, "The sword of truth doesn't err. The sword of falsehood isn't true. I will give you money, but not my life." You wonder, like, why he even bothered to give him this sack of gold, but just to help him out. Maybe it's like, he needs a better job. Give him a head start. Xingchang was dumbfounded because he couldn't cut into this neck. When he finally came to his senses, he begged forgiveness and said he wanted to become a monk. Huineng handed him the gold and said, "You'd better leave." right? Otherwise, I'm afraid my followers will harm you, because they also would probably like to kill your teacher. He didn't say that. You can change your appearance and come back later, and I will take you in. So compassionate, huh? Come back, and even though you tried to kill me, you can come practice with me later. Xing Cheng did as he was told and disappeared that night. Later, he left home and became a monk and was diligent in his observation of the precepts. One day, he remembered Hui Neng's words, and he made the long journey to pay his respects. Hui Neng said, "I've been thinking of you for a long time. What took you so long?" Xing Cheng said, "In the past, I received the Master's forgiveness for my crime. Although I have now left home and have been practicing austerities, I'll never be able to repay your kindness unless I can transmit the Dharma and liberate others. Your disciple, me, has often read the Parinirvana Sutra. But I don't understand the meaning of permanence and impermanence." Because it's pretty weird, huh? But may you, Hui Neng, be compassionate enough to explain this a little? So Hui Neng said, this is the part that Dogen quotes, "What is impermanent is your Buddha nature. What is permanent is the mind that discriminates all good and bad dharmas." So there's a little ambiguity here, because the way the Chinese works is that word of mujo means, it could be translated as impermanent or impermanence, which may play out to be quite a big difference in the way Dogen likes to play with this. To say impermanence is Buddha nature is quite different than saying Buddha nature is impermanent. But here, actually, he says, what is impermanent? So maybe there is, I didn't look at the Chinese, but maybe there's a marker that's like making it into a noun. What is impermanent? It does actually imply impermanence. What is impermanent is your Buddha nature. What is permanent is the mind that discriminates all good and bad dharmas, which is, you know, kind of the opposite of what the sutra teaches. The discriminating mind is impermanent, and the Buddha says that in the early teachings as well. But then we have this new Mahayana teaching of Buddha nature that he says is permanent in the Nirvana Sutra. But the Six Ancestors says the opposite. What is impermanent is your Buddha nature. What's permanent is the mind that discriminates all good and bad dharmas. So the monk Xing Cheng said, "But the Master's explanation completely contradicts what the Sutra says." And Hui Neng says, "I transmit the mind seal of Buddhas. How could I dare contradict the Sutras of the Buddha?" Xing Cheng said, "But the Sutra says that the Buddha nature is permanent, and yet the Master says it's impermanent, and that good and bad dharmas, even the Bodhi mind, are all impermanent. And yet, the Master says they're permanent. These are contradictions and have only made this student even more perplexed." You thought you were perplexed by the Parinirvana Sutra, maybe, but now you may be even more perplexed along with Xing Cheng. Hui Neng said, "In the past, when I heard the nun Wu Qin Tsang reciting the Parinirvana Sutra, I explained it to her, and not one of my explanations or interpretations failed to agree with the sutra. Nor is it the case now with you." Xing Cheng said, "This student's intelligence is limited. Could you, Master, please explain the ins and outs of this?" So I appreciate his humility, instead of saying, like, "Well, you're just talking nonsense, teacher. You're saying the opposite of the sutra." Instead, it's kind of like, "Well, I did come here to practice with you. Maybe you have something more profound understanding, even though it seems to contradict the sutra. Maybe my intelligence is limited." Hui Neng said, so here's the explanation. No. The Dogen doesn't give. Huainong says, don't you realize that if the Buddha nature, much less any good or bad dharma you can name, is permanent, then between now and the end of the kalpa, no one would be able to set their mind on enlightenment. If Buddha nature, or anything else for that matter, is permanent and can't change, then over time, between now and the end of the kalpa, we're talking about time, like which is where we arouse bodhicitta, we arouse the mind set on enlightenment in like a particular moment in time. But if this is permanent and there's no time here, how can there be anything? How can there be good and bad? How can there be precepts? How can there be the thought of enlightenment if this Buddha nature is this fixed, permanent thing? So it's a little argument that's not in the sutra. The Buddha might not disagree, but I think what Huainong is doing and what Dogen is often doing too is just being really creative about the use of these terms. He's saying, well, you know, here's the sutra and you think you understand it, and you probably do, and the sutra is great and we don't contradict the sutra, but here's like another angle just so we don't get complacent in our understanding. It's another twist on permanence. If you see permanence as a kind of fixed lockdown thing where you nothing can happen, then how can you ever practice and do anything? And we could say parenthetically that, well, what the Buddha is talking about, remember, is the nitya paramita, the transcendent permanence that actually isn't a fixed, lockdown, frozen permanence. It's the impermanent, what we call the transcendent permanence, remember, is that which is free from the extreme views of permanence, a fixed permanence and impermanence. Thus, and so Huainong goes on to say, thus what I call impermanent is simply what the Buddha calls the way of true permanence. So he's just kind of redefining this transcendent permanence as impermanence. The true permanence in capital letters, or the transcendent permanence, I call impermanent. Because he's a Zen ancestor, he can do that. Moreover, if dharmas were all impermanent, this is now we're going to hear the argument for the opposite, for the next sentence. If dharmas were all impermanent, which is the usual understanding, then the self nature of everything would be subject to birth and death. But there is no place where the nature that is truly permanent doesn't reach. Thus, what I call permanent is simply what the Buddha means by true impermanence. And I hear this as it's revolving around this term self-nature, the svabhava of everything. He's saying, if all dharmas were impermanent, then the self-nature of everything would be subject to birth and death. And that self-nature is this term in the Mahayana that gets used in both ways, actually. It gets used, it's sometimes translated as inherent existence, and there is no self-nature. There's svabhava, from like basically Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna's whole work of the verses on the middle way is that's what he's basically negating, this svabhava, inherent existence of things, true existence or self-nature of things, like an abiding, fixed nature. So, but svabhava or self-nature can also be used as like the, the three self-natures of all phenomena. Remember the imputational, the other dependent, and the thoroughly established. for those who studied Yogacara. Those are called three svabhavas, the three self-natures. So the thoroughly established true nature of all phenomena that's actually suchness is called a self-nature. The true self-nature of all things is suchness. So I don't know if that's what he's playing with here, but we do have in the Indian tradition, it gets used as this locked down, fixed, inherent existence that we have to refute because it's completely an illusion, and the true nature of all things. This term, self-nature, is a very dynamic word. So again, now going back to Wei Nong, he says, moreover, if dharmas were all impermanent, then the self-nature of everything would be subject to birth and death. So if you hear it as this inherent existence, then inherent existent things would be coming and going. But if you hear self-nature as like the true suchness of things, that doesn't come and go. So if dharmas were all impermanent, then self-nature would be subject to birth and death. But all dharmas are permanent, he's saying. All these phenomena are permanent. So actually, self-nature is not subject to birth and death. Maybe one way to look at it. Thus, what I call permanent is simply what the Buddha means by true impermanence. Because ordinary people and members of other schools cling to a mistaken permanence, and followers of the two vehicles claim that such permanence is impermanent, but then create the eight inverted views. In other words, those four that we just talked about, those four seals, and their reversals, thinking that permanence is impermanent, thinking that impermanent is permanent, thinking that suffering is bliss, thinking that bliss is suffering. Those are the eight inverted views. Through his penetrating teaching in the Parinirvana Sutra, the Buddha refuted their biased views and clarified true permanence, true joy, true self, and true purity. You've been clinging to the words and turning your back on the meaning. By using the impermanence of annihilation and the permanence of certain death, you have mistaken the Buddha's perfect and profound final instructions. Even if you read them 1,000 times, what good would they do you? Xing Chang suddenly felt awake and spoke this verse. And, the other translation, he's had this great awakening. So I think Red Pines may be saying, like, let's kind of like start looking at this, Satori thing in a little different way. Xingshan suddenly felt awake. He felt awake and spoke this verse. Because we hold on to an impermanent mind, the Buddha spoke of our permanent nature. Those unaware of skillful means gather pebbles in the springtime water. Maybe we could see like they're sorting around for these little bits of these teachings in the rushing water. Without my lifting a finger, my Buddha nature appears before me. It wasn't bestowed on me by my teacher, nor did I obtain anything at all. An awakening verse. Wei Nong said, now you've reached the bottom and are well named Jirche, which means determined to reach the bottom. Jirche bowed and returned to his seat. That's the extended version. Which Dogen quotes a line. And it's central. Part of this fascicle, Impermanence is Buddha Nature. Somebody, Joan Stombach, wrote a book called Impermanence is Buddha Nature, just exploring this part of this fascicle, and some other things. She basically mostly looking at Dogen's Buddha Nature fascicle and Dogen's Time Being fascicle, which is also about impermanence. Right? So it's a kind of neat book which tries to bring in a lot of Western thinkers and correlate them with Dogen's view of time, being, and Buddha Nature. So this is just... well, maybe I'll save her piece from that book. This is Heejin Kim's mystical realist commenting on this section. He says, this a beautiful little paragraph, I thought. The impermanence of Buddha nature is that aspect of Buddha nature which eternally comes into being and out of being with the universe. In other words, all existence. I'll read again. The impermanence of Buddha nature is that aspect of Buddha nature which eternally, permanently, comes into being and out of being, arises and ceases with the universe, all existence. And again, I think of another term we often use, that can you imagine what I'm thinking of when I hear those lines? That which comes into being and out of being with the whole universe. Can you think, what would be another name for that? To me, it brings up dependent co-arising. The interdependent arising and ceasing of everything, inconceivably. Arising and ceasing, all existence. It pulsates with the arising and perishing of the universe at any given moment in accordance with the infinitely intricate functional interdependence of its constituents. Buddha nature gives birth to a new creation from moment to moment, sharing the fate of the universe. Being and becoming, and I think he's using these here as being is just what is, being as is, no coming and going, and becoming is the becoming and ceasing, the arising and ceasing. He's using them as kind of opposites here. The being, kind of permanent, we could say, permanent being and impermanent becoming, are not two separate metaphysical realities, but one and the same in the process of impermanence. The religious and philosophical significance of impermanence is the infinite versatility and dynamism of Buddha nature in its ever-changing and ever-becoming character. Quite a beautiful writer. And there's a lot. He packs a lot of words into a sentence. I thought that was an inspired vision of Buddha nature as not some kind of like mystical, transcendent, ethereal state to like, you know, suddenly reach somehow. But the inconceivable, because it's too dynamic and too vast to get a hold of it, because it includes everything. But that arising and ceasing expression of everything, that manifestation that we call the whole universe, completely interdependent, nothing can be unconnected from that whole, and that's Buddha nature in its kind of manifest expression, we call the universe. Anyway, this is before now Dogen. Now we hear Dogen. He says, commenting on this Platform Sutra quote, he says, the impermanence that the Six Ancestors speaks of is not the impermanence deduced by the non-Buddhists and those of the lesser vehicle. Their ancestors and those who have succeeded them preach impermanence, but they do not plumb its full extent. Maybe just a narrow, limited version of, yeah, things arise and cease. I got it. So simple, impermanent. We're talking about vast, inconceivable impermanence called Buddha nature. The preaching, practicing, and realizing of impermanence by the impermanent themselves can be no other than impermanent. Those who teach, practice, and realize impermanence are, like the Buddha, are the impermanent. Those who are now manifesting, so that's where, now, this is where Dogen's now bringing it up. It's the gen here of Genjo Koan. Manifesting, actualizing, or appearing are all translations of gen. Those who are now manifesting themselves to save others are manifesting themselves in their impermanence and teaching Dharma. And this is Buddha nature. And that line right there is a reference, as Dogen often does, to the Lotus Sutra, where chapter 25, the Universal Gateway chapter, Avalokiteshvara chapter of the Lotus Sutra, where there's all these verses where the teaching is that Avalokiteshvara, the great compassionate Bodhisattva, manifests herself as a fisherman, car washer, a monk, a nun, a scientist, anything, basically. It's a long list of all these verses that she can manifest as to save beings in those forms as skillful means. It's a beautiful part of the Lotus Sutra. But it's about great compassion manifesting in all these different various forms in order to save beings that can only relate to them in those forms, because if the Buddha appeared at the car wash and tried to teach Buddha nature to the other car washers, they'd just be like, huh? But if the Buddha manifests as another car washer and washes the cars with them and says, by the way, have you ever noticed the way we're washing the cars is like, as we're sitting here spraying them, that we're like kind of like connected with all the other stuff around us too? And the other car washer is like, wow, yeah, I know, I never thought of that. It's cool. So that's why she sometimes manifests as car washers. So here's the... those who are now manifesting themselves to save others are manifesting themselves in their impermanence, Dogen adds in, and teaching Dharma. That's, a section of the Lotus Sutra. This is Buddha nature. Moreover, at times they manifest a long body, and at times they manifest a short body. There's some koan where somebody asks the teacher, something like, what is Buddha? Or what's the... And I think it was actually, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? And he says, come back late at night and I'll tell you. I think this is how the story goes. And so the monk comes back and he goes, okay, are you ready? Come, follow me out here. And they go down the corridor and come here, don't follow. Through the door, down another corridor. Okay, over here. And they go out into the garden. Okay, nobody can see us. See this bamboo? Yeah. This bamboo is long. This bamboo is short.
So, in the Wadalabe, It's a long dharma body.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's dharmakaya. Yeah. Moreover, at times they manifest a long dharmakaya, and times a short dharmakaya, which is a nice thing because dharmakaya, right, is like this transcendent, immaterial, true body of the Buddha, inconceivable Buddha body, you know. And then the dharma, we've talked about this before, and then dharmakaya manifests as the nirmanakaya. It manifests as a transformation body, like called like Shakyamuni Buddha, who's like 5'8½" and, you know, wears a patch robe and stuff. And so the dharmakaya is not manifest in traditionally. So this is Dogen playing with the same kind of rhetoric that he's kind of getting into here, right? Moreover, these impermanent beings, sometimes they manifest a long dharma body. Like the sizeless, formless dharma body is sometimes long and it's sometimes short. So yeah, according to traditional teachings, that's ridiculous. But it's those two sides again. Sometimes they manifest a long dharma body. Buddha nature can manifest short or long or short, undifferentiated dharma body. The permanent saint is impermanent. The permanent unenlightened person is impermanent. Or you could translate as holy and ordinary. Sometimes you hear this in other koans. Maybe better. The permanent holy one is impermanent. The permanent ordinary one is impermanent. And it's referring to the noble ones on the path. There are certain stages traditionally of like non-regression, where it's like this realization cannot be lost. After the path of seeing, for example, there's the path of insight into emptiness, and it's like no matter how distracted you try to be after that, you can't lose the understanding, but you can get in lots of trouble. You can still like, because you still have empty karmic tendencies that so you really know that they're empty, but you really let them control your actions and therefore harm others. So therefore, the so-called path of seeing or insight in the traditional teachings is not the end of the path. There's a path of cultivation where you have to integrate your insight into your understanding. We have lots of American Zen scandals arising these days and always. And I don't know what the minds of those teachers were like, but I can imagine that they maybe had some really deep insight into emptiness, maybe even path of seeing, which is pretty exalted in the Indian description, but it's not the end of the path. And if people take that as the end of the path and don't kind of apply it to all their karmic tendencies, then you can have a kind of, we say insight, but still get in a lot of trouble. There is in the ancient teachings, it's called the path of no more learning. These are the five paths that are like the path of practice. And there's accumulation of merit, it's the first path. Preparation is like intensive study and intensive conceptual understanding of emptiness, as well as intensive meditation practice. Is the preparation, and then the insight comes. It's like a pivotal moment, and then the cultivation, you know. And they said sometimes that these two paths take like eons. This is just one moment, the insight, and then this cultivation is like eons to go afterwards. while you're integrating this insight. And then there is the path of no more learning that's like a Buddha, based in the Mahayana, is like a Buddha, where you actually do finish. There are Indian versions. It's possible to finish the path. There's no more learning or cultivation, actually. In Zen, we say, Buddha means going beyond Buddha. No more learning means continue learning. That's kind of the Zen style. There's no end ever, ever, ever. Because Buddha nature is impermanence. So, anyway, that's a little bit about the Aryas, the saints, the holy ones, the noble ones, the permanent holy ones are, with non-regressing ones, you could say, are impermanent. The permanent, ordinary person is impermanent. For saints and ignorant, or holy and ordinary people, to be permanently saints or permanently ignorant would not be the Buddha nature. It would only be the foolish notions of small minds, restricted knowledge spun from discriminatory speculation. Buddha would thus be reduced to a small, limited body and nature to narrow, restricted activity. Hence the sixth ancestor uttered the words, impermanence is in itself Buddha nature. Permanence is prior to turning into enlightenment. And turning is... some commentators say that it refers to that Yogacara term of the transformation of the basis, where the storehouse consciousness is overturned. The illusion of the storehouse consciousness is overturned and reveals the full non-dual wisdom of Buddha. That's the character they use for the transformation is turning. So permanence is prior to this turning or transformation. But even though the Buddha nature turns into the wisdom that cuts away the passions, cuts away the afflictions, the kleshas, or becomes the worldly kleshas being cut away, prior to turning is never associated with traces of coming or going. Hence it's said to be permanent in the sense of Buddha nature as impermanence. For that reason, the very impermanence of grass and tree, thicket and forest is Buddha nature. So we're now bringing in non-sentient beings, we're bringing in like plants and forests. The very impermanence of people and things, body and mind, is the Buddha nature. Lands and nations, mountains and rivers are impermanent because they are Buddha nature. They're impermanent because they're Buddha nature. Thinking of the Buddha nature as we've been talking about it. Supreme complete enlightenment, because it's Buddha nature, is impermanent. Usually that would be said to be permanent. Great nirvana is usually said to be permanent, because it's impermanent, is Buddha nature. Those holding the narrow views of the lesser vehicle, Buddhist scholars of the sutras and shastras and the like, will be suspicious, surprised, and frightened when confronted by these words of the sixth ancestor. If so, then they belong with devils and heretics. So, impermanence is Buddha nature, and that includes grasses, trees, walls, tiles, pebbles. Everything is included in the totality of the universe, where nothing is lacking from that totality, nothing's extra. And the totality itself doesn't come and go. The impermanent, the sea of impermanent things always remains this Buddha nature ocean that includes everything. So that's the end of that section. We could talk about that more later. If you have more questions on all these inanimate objects being expressions, manifestations of Buddha nature, and impermanence as Buddha nature, we could touch on again before we get into the next story. The last class next week, I think, yeah. Buddha nature. May all beings practice, realize, and manifest Buddha nature continuously and impermanently. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become.